Hey, I'm Zale, host of Preconceived, a podcast that challenges the preconceptions that shape how we view the world. Preconceived examines both our approach to major life choices, but also our perspectives on issues to which we may have been overly conditioned towards certain opinions. Each episode features a different topic, with experts, researchers, and luminaries in their respective fields. We think you will especially enjoy recent episodes on polyamory, regretting parenthood, dopamine nation, and myths of the beauty industry. Find Preconceived wherever you get your podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, folks. Really special episode today. Bridie and I got to sit down with two guests. The couple behind the wonderful podcast, Sex Evangelicals. Julia and Jeremiah are both certified sex therapists who grew up in different religious communities. And from their experiences, they speak to singles and couples who are on their own healing path from shame, disillusionment, and allegiance to the church. We're mixing two things that often don't get mixed together, sex and religion. It was a beautiful conversation. We absolutely love these two, and we think that you will too. So enjoy this episode with our new friends, Julia and Jeremiah. Today's guests are Julia and Jeremiah, the hosts of Sex Evangelicals, which is a podcast that lays out the sex education that the church didn't want you to have. Julia and Jeremiah are certified sex therapists hailing from Boston, the Boston area, and they both grew up in religious communities, which sets the stage for a lot of what they talk about now. They are having regular conversations in their work and on their podcast about the ways that growing up in religious context can scramble our approaches to intimacy and sexuality. We are so thrilled to have the both of you on the podcast today. Sex, religion, you know, money, politics, those are about the four things that, like, I've always just felt like most people do not want to fucking talk about. Well, so let's throw death and illness in there too. But to take sex and religion, I feel like it's kind of mixing like oil and water for most people. I'm so excited to dive into this. First of all, I mean, introduce yourself to our listeners. Give us a little bit more insight into who the two of you are.
Sure. So is there anything specific that you'd like us to share?
I mean, you know, what's your, whatever comes to mind. Yeah, give me the first thing that pops in your mind that you want people to know about you.
What I want people to know about me is that I am the best cannoli customer in all of the city of Utrecht. So
that's what I'm talking about.
I do have a reputation in my current city, and I'm taking that with me wherever I go. in all seriousness, Jeremiah and I are licensed psychotherapists. We're certified sex therapists, and We both grew up in different versions of fundamentalist Christianity. So we can talk a little bit later about the diversity that exists within evangelical, Mormon, and Pentecostal communities. However, what binds them all together is negative, restrictive, gendered messages around relationships and sexuality, which have harmed both of us as individuals, harmed relationships in our lives. And so in our own healing process, we decided that we would dedicate our careers to supporting folks wherever they land in or outside of a religious spectrum to have healthy, flourishing relationships and sexuality.
I love that. I love that. I guess the first thing to kind of question is, at what point did, well, I actually, when did you two meet? And like, what's the origin story here between the two of you?
We met at the end of 2018. And we actually, funny enough, we both have the same supervisor. So we kind of inadvertently got connected through that, and found pretty quickly that we have shared interests in sex therapy and sexual health and relational health. And also at the time, both you and I were doing some lectures at different Christian universities around sexual health. So we had figured out how to support each other, and that pretty quickly moved into a dating relationship and talking about how we can collaborate our shared interests and have some fun while doing it too.
Christian universities no longer want us. We pushed the envelopes too far for too long. So we burned those bridges, but we supported each other in the process.
Mm-hmm. It's so funny that you said that, because as soon as you said that, I was like, is there a much of a demand for that, for sex, like health, sexual health classes at Christian churches?
You would be surprised. So, so at least at the university that I went to, sexual health tends to fall into one of two camps. One camp is talking about sexuality kind of under the guise of, oh my gosh, we said sex. We're so progressive. And then it's really a conversation about like relationships. I took a couple of sex therapy classes actually at my college, Abilene Christian. They were both decent. It could have been a lot worse. The other camp that Christian universities go to is influencers who write about the performance of gender, kind of in the context of a literalist interpretation of scripture, and unfortunately, the university I went to, a lot of other universities have invested in those. Kind of the current version of that is like the tradwife kind of trend that's coming up. But there's also a lot of other more legalistic interpretations of expressions of that that are going through speaker circuits at like Liberty University. And apparently my alma mater as well. So
can you tradwife? That's a term I'm not familiar with, but I think, I mean, even just hearing you say that, I think I'm already concocting what that likely means, but what can you break that down?
Yeah, we have never talked about that on the show. And I'm so glad.
I saw you nodding your head, and I was like, oh, Brady must be in the know.
Oh, I'm in the know.
Brady must be a tradwife herself.
No, I'm not. But I am so, I think you folks are so the people to tell us about what's going on there.
Yeah. Well, we can think about this as a Venn diagram, and the trad wife exists between the Venn diagram of evangelical Christian spaces and also the wellness world, not particularly rooted in good sorts of science. And so many folks within the trad wife world do have some evangelical roots. That's a whole sector that we can dissect. And then there are other folks who might not claim an evangelical type of background, but have a different type of fundamentalism that can still be quite pervasive. And ultimately, the end of it is that the gendered norms really reinforce what a woman's role is within the home, as a wife, as a mother. Ooh. And I had a colleague who got sucked into that space. And he had posted something on social media about the divine feminine and the divine masculine. Ooh. And as I was reading it, I was thinking, oh, all of these words are actually exactly what I learned in my evangelical spaces around what it means to perform gender. And if a person fits within those categories, that's great. Mm-hmm. That's certainly not a criticism of that. But when that's enforced that, oh, being a woman is this. And if you mm-hmm. are a woman, you can only be a woman if you connect to your divine feminine or connect to your Proverbs 31 identity. You know, that's when it becomes problematic.
I something you just said there too about like people who are maybe showing up in these spaces, but they don't relate necessarily to an evangelical, but it's like so in there. That is the shit that I am so curious about when it comes to our religious upbringings and how it shows up in our lives and our self-expression and whatnot. Even if we don't consider ourselves as religious or we don't maybe like relate to, we don't think we're being influenced by it in some way. And like, from what I've seen of the trad wife, it looks very like granola female influencer showing up, talking to the camera.
I mean, again, the wellness, like you said, the wellness sort of, we're seeing like this, especially in the advent of COVID, like this huge rise in the like wellness influencer space, which is, you know, it's a space that I mean, as yoga instructors who, you know, the two of us taught yoga for, you know, I taught for the better part of a decade. Brady, you've been teaching for I don't know what, like almost 20 years.
Yeah, close 17.
Yeah, and like it's not something that we're unfamiliar with. Like those, you know, those folks existed within that space, but after COVID, it feels like it just brought so much of that, you know, out of the woodworks. And it's so it's just so insidiously misleading and misguided. And I can totally see how that gets kind of swept up within this.
And the swing on the, like the tick of like the trad wife too, it often, I could be wrong because I haven't like tuned in or watched any of these channels, but what I've heard is it's not just like, you know, I clean my whole house with like vinegar and water or and stuff like that, but like also I show up for my man in this very particular way I am this kind of mother and I am like really proud of the way of the role that I fit inside,
which I mean, for some people,
absolutely.
Yeah. For some people it's like, I do. And I fucking love it. But then, you know, for some people, maybe not, you know,
that's right, Jeremy, because one of our jobs as couples and sex therapists is to give people as many options as they can.
Yes.
To figure out how to solve problems together, to figure out how to have positive experiences together. And Jeremy, like you're saying, like maybe someone decides that they fit into these particular activities and that's something that they enjoy. The problem comes when there's a language in these types of systems that that either moralize engagement or more commonly lack of engagement in the values of the community. Or place a sense of obligation, like you have to do this in order to be a healthy person. Well, no, like there's lots of ways to practice health. There's lots of ways to practice relational health, and our job is to kind of expand the options that folks have, rather than reduce the amount of options that people have.
Ooh. Right. Mm-hmm. And to go back to something you were saying, Bride. I'll steal a line from Jeremiah because sometimes we steal the lines that one person says more often than others. But especially in the United States, you don't need to have grown up in the church to have been fucked over by the church because abstinence-only education, the marriage of right-wing politics with conservative, often evangelical Christianity pervades so many spaces. And when I have clients who didn't necessarily grow up in as explicitly fundamentalist community as me, they still are unpacking some of the same messages, even if it was in a different packaging, a different wrapper, a different shade of lipstick. we're often doing the same type of work.
I one thing I would love to just kind of dive into is both of your own personal sort of experience with religion. You know, what was the religion that you were brought into as you were growing up in your family, and how did your relationship to religion evolve as you started to mature and grow and start to, you know, make decisions for yourself?
Do you want to
I'll start?
Start?
Yeah. So I grew up in a denomination called the Church of Christ. The Church of Christ has about a million and a half people, mostly located in southeastern U.S. The calling card is a cappella music, a cappella worship. So I grew up in those spaces, moved into leadership positions, learned pretty quickly that, like, I got a lot of attention, a lot of positive attention by stepping into those spaces. So that was something that was really meaningful. I began kind of moving out. I think my first hit to the religious community. There is a lot of sexism in the denomination. Sexism around men being encouraged, but more importantly, women being told they're not to step into leadership positions. Leadership mm-hmm. positions exclusively belong to men. That could be in terms of playing roles in like corporate worship. That could be in other areas as well. And my when I was in high school, my church actually split. There was a group of people who said, no, this is stupid. We want to have women play more expansive roles in our church. And then there was a group of people who said, no, we want to like keep with the, quote, tradition. The Church of Christ, by the way, is about 125 years old. So keep mm-hmm. tradition with hold tradition with a grain of salt. Mm-hmm. But that was kind of the first big thing for me and recognizing, like, this is stupid. You people are really like going to split because of this. And while that was going on, like I also in my 20s, my first career is in worship ministry. I worked at a church of about 2,200 in Texas for about 6 years when I was in college and a little bit after. As I was engaging in that, I also began studying family therapy and learning more about social construction, reading a fair bit of Foucault and Jacques Derrida and the kind of the early 20th or mid 20th century French deconstruction philosophers. And so I was in two worlds. And as I like later figured out, you know, with conservative religion, it's really hard to exist in both of those worlds at the same time. At Ooh. Some point, especially as I began to study sex therapy, at some point, like I had to make a choice. And in my case, that choice was made for me. I got fired from a church about 6 years ago at this stage. I didn't go back. I got fired from my positions and my views on sexuality and my desire to talk about them, with other people. The wrong people had enough power to say, yeah, we need to get this guy out essentially. Ooh. So that was my journey. In my case, the church made that decision for me. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of folks that we are studying in kind of the deconstruction movement is the kind of most common terminology for the in group or for the group of people. A lot of people realize that the values of the church, especially the values of the evangelical church, no mm-hmm. longer one are actually being practiced as they're being taught. So values mm-hmm. of kindness, compassion, caring, hospitality that you learn as kids, the evangelical church, especially in public spaces, are showcasing those less and less. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are saying, you know what, I'm making the decision. I cannot ethically participate in these spaces anymore. Mm-hmm. And then as wow. these folks move out, whether they're kicked out like me or Julia, you fall more into the latter category. there's a huge sense of loss, a huge sense of grief that comes with that.
Yeah.
Because you're losing not just a faith philosophy, but you're also losing a community. You're losing relationships.
Yeah. When you said you found it hard to exist in both of those spaces, were you referring to the space of your religion, but and also the space of philosophy? Was that what you were referring to?
The space of religion and specifically the space of postmodern philosophy, and social construction, that the specific brand of therapy that I learned about is rooted in. So
I find that so interesting because for the longest time I was like a staunch atheist and like kind of a prick about it too. And then I had an experience that sort of shook me out of that. And I would say probably pushed me more into the space of
agnostic.
Thank you. But just recently over the last, like year, I've been having another shift and really like finding a really deep fascination in religion and spirituality, but also in philosophy. And, I just recently started reading very casually, but reading through the Old and the New Testament and I find it very fascinating to look at the way that religion was taught, or at least, you know, it is what we expect to be taught. When you compare it to philosophy, it seems like it is just that. I mean, you know, philosophy and religion seem like they truly go hand in hand. I don't know enough about modern takes on each, but when I hear you say like, oh, it's hard to exist in both of these worlds at the same time, the first thing that just comes to my mind is like, well, I mean, aren't they one and the same?
You know, isn't?
But I think that with religion, one of the things that happens with religion is that you also develop a whole set of cultural rules and cultural expectations around those that don't necessarily happen with philosophy.
Sure.
And in the case of the evangelical circles that Julia, you and I grew up in, there are also eschatological, so meaning that there's like both what you do in the life, but also in the afterlife, and in the philosophy, the religions that you and I both grew up in, the afterlife actually takes precedent over the present life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And religious communities are diverse. As you're talking, Jeremy, I'm thinking, well, of course. I would love us all to be able to exist in those worlds. I don't think that they need to be mutually exclusive. I find it sad that in some religious communities they are. In my religious community of origin, I had a very restrictive understanding of basically every single part of my life. So it didn't allow for the really beautiful exploration and the questions that philosophy gives us. Philosophy asks really good questions, and I was not allowed to ask questions because I was given the answers from before I can actually even remember.
And one of the hard things is that in the U.S., you have like political systems that are developing around these religious beliefs. We're actually seeing this in the U.S. with the release of Project 2025, which is a document, 900-page document published by the Heritage Foundation and other ultra-conservative groups in the United States that are like very legalistic, like practices of and understandings of scripture written into public policy, written into law. And that can be really scary. It's actually a pretty scary document to read. Mm-hmm. in ways that doesn't happen with other like philosophies. I'm trying to think like, I'm a big Slavoj Žižek fan, and I'm trying to think about what would happen if like a political system was developed around Žižek's ideas. Probably not going to happen.
Right, right. It's such a shame because again, like having spent so much of my time, of my life, just kind of like sticking my nose up to religion, and now just like kind of, I don't know, just getting more interested in it. It's so challenging because there is such a beauty to religion. There really
Absolutely.
Is.
Totally.
And it's just such a fucking shame that it is so mired in just atrocities and you know, inequality and
That's
like
right.
all of these things that just like really restrict the human spirit, which is which is kind of ironic. You know, it's just such a bummer. And so, you know, I can only imagine, you know, your reference there to this sense of grief, the sense of loss when you all of a sudden had this thing that was so prevalent and so present in your life. And then having this fundamental shift where it's like, I have to go or I am being ostracized. Mm-hmm. And I no longer, you know, I mean, did you in that sort of evolution of stepping back from your community, did you guys struggle with even being able to maintain a grasp on your religion? You know, like I can see how some people would absolutely kind of the pendulum would swing from one side all the way to the other where it's like, fuck this and fuck religion and I'm out, like I'm gonna, you know. What was that experience like for you guys?
I don't think I had a swing to the other end of the pendulum in which I had an idea of fuck all religion.
Yeah.
I had enough positive experiences within more progressive spaces to show me that Christianity has the power to be diverse. It has the power to be healing and helpful for individuals, communities, and all of society. Unfortunately, for all sorts of issues, that is often not the case. And often mm-hmm. religious groups can be the source of trauma and abuse. That being said, I don't think I struggled with the same grief as many of my peers. I definitely struggled with grief after leaving a religious community, which in my case came with a divorce. But I feel lucky that I have always been able to hold on to a sense of spirituality, and I haven't really sensed any pressure from myself or from other people to define that. And for many people leaving religious communities, not having definitions around their worldview, their religion, or their spirituality can be very unmooring. I'm glad that it wasn't unmooring. That being said, I did become a yoga instructor as well. And I never like moved into the wellness space in any big way, especially because when I did my training, wellness hadn't boomed in the same way as it has over the past few years. But I think it would have been so easy for me to get sucked into those spaces because without much reflection, it seems so different. It's inclusive. It's vibrant. It has all the things that I didn't get in church. And depending on the type of community, you might get sucked into all kinds of wellness spaces, including the yoga world, in which there's a different kind of fundamentalism. So I got dangerously close to that, but fortunately avoided it.
Yeah, I think about the context of the time too. Like, you know, it was definitely 17 years ago doing the yoga teacher training. It was like just the beginning of it being cool to do yoga trainings, but like no social media yet. Like I have no pictures to prove that I did my teacher training, you know, in Thailand or any of that kind of stuff. But yeah, I think I talked to you previously about our friends over at Conspirituality and their work. And our drive to belong is so strong that to go from the pot, like one pot into a, basically into another pot would be so, so easy.
Yeah.
Very easy.
Yeah. I just want to say thank you for providing us with that context, because, you know, I do find it just utterly fascinating, especially to hear people's experiences with their religion and their spirituality and how those things shift. Because I think for a lot of people, again, like I said earlier, like people often shy away from talking about these sorts of things. And so it's just nice and refreshing to hear the two of you speak so openly about your experiences. So in terms of like sexuality and religion, you know, what are, and whether this is like, you know, from the side of more sort of fundamentalist Christianity or as, you know, Christianity as a whole, are there any like positive aspects to the way that sex is being approached or discussed or viewed from whether it's institutions or, you know, or communities or churches? What are the positives there within the space of sexuality? Or are there any?
I'll say the United Church of Christ.
Yeah,
correct?
Yeah, yeah.
The
yeah,
United
yeah.
Church of Christ, not to be confused with Jeremiah's community of origin, actually has a really beautiful, comprehensive sexual education program. Amazing.
It's called the OWL program.
And that stands for Our Whole Lives. Mm. I don't know of any other denomination that has created something like that. Folks might be familiar with a woman named Nadia Boltz-Weber. She's actually a Lutheran pastor, and she has written a book, Shameless, about the intersection of conservative Christianity and religious shame. She actually had this really beautiful ceremony in which people melted their purity rings into this golden vulva statue. Oh, cool. So definitely people within religious spaces are trying to do good work with sexuality. Those are absolutely the exceptions. So if someone asked me, is there any benefit to abstinence-only education? I would say zero benefit, because that is enforced. If a person wants to make an informed choice about what sexual experiences they will have with certain people before or after certain relational commitments, that's fine. But if that is presented as the only option and an option with eternal consequences, which was how it was framed for me, then that is only harmful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I would add to that, the education that I received as an elementary school kid, sure, there were like messages around the Bible, Bible stories, and we can have conversations about like later about like mythology and the roles of that. But the other part of that was like, I learned to be a good person in those spaces. Those were the spaces that I learned about sharing. Those are the spaces that I learned about. My church spaces wouldn't use the word consent, but processes that I learned were consent adjacent, asking questions, asking for permission. And there's across the board, a lot of churches teach their young children those types of values that are actually really foundational values for developing into healthy sexual people. But when kids become adolescents, the education becomes much more about allegiance and identification with the evangelical church itself and the political parties that it aligns with. And it moves away from the values and the ethics that were that were taught in early childhood, elementary age.
The only thing that I would add would be a gender difference. So I agree with Jeremiah that I grew up learning to be hospitable and generous. However, I can remember being prepubescent, around 9 years old, and having conversations with my friends about whether or not spaghetti straps were sinful, because God forbid an older adult male be tempted to sin or lust by a small girl. So I feel incredibly torn because I do hold many of the values that Christian communities claim to support. In actuality, many religious communities don't actually practice that.
Yeah.
And to be afraid of hell and to be afraid that something I wore could be something that would cause harm to me and it would be my fault is a crushing pressure for an 8, 9, 10-year-old girl. I received modesty talks as early as 8 years old.
Yeah. Turn Me On Podcast. We'll be back after this short break.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
That something just landed for me in that what you just said coupled with what you said before it about the eternal consequences of that must be so confusing, and I'm not going to disclude myself from this because I had my own upbringing, but in terms of, okay, but when someone in, especially someone in your own community does something to a vulnerable small little girl, and then the messaging is that that's yours to carry eternally. And somehow, like, it all of a sudden the pieces are clicking on why the responsibility we feel when, as like a little girl, an adult man can do something that you have to be responsible for and you have to carry, and it belongs, it's your eternal consequences.
Yeah, girls become the gatekeeper of all sexuality, adult male sexuality, peer sexuality, way before they even hit adolescence.
Mm-hmm. That is that's a great word for it, the gatekeepers. Mm. I just feel like I have to share this little anecdote. I was thinking about it on my walk over here, and maybe you can tell me how I should have better handled this, but I was at the gym the other day, and this girl in the change room, she was kind of frustrated because she had shown up at the gym and she didn't have a t-shirt. And so she tapped me on the shoulder, or she asked me, she's like, "You don't happen to have an extra t-shirt, do you?" She was kind of like standing in front of the mirror, like adjusting her sports bra, like assessing whether or not she could go out into the weight room, loads of people are, right? And yeah. I was like, you can go, like, you can totally go out there like that. Like, nobody's going to think twice about it. She goes, "Oh, well, I'm trying to like be modest." And I was like, modest for who? You know, I thought we were doing like this.
Right.
We're girlfriends in the locker room. Like, modest for who? Like, you're good. You look great. And she was like, "Modest for God." I said,
"Yeah, what did you say?" "Holy shit."
I said, because I'm just always cracking jokes, I was like, "Oh, I don't think he works out here on Fridays."
"Yes, I love it."
But she did not, did not register.
It would have registered if it was a Sunday, but yes.
But to me, and you know, I thought about this like my whole workout. I was like, you know, what should I have said something else? Like, you know, whatever. But I don't know someone else's relationship to God. The God of my understanding is there's, of course, it's at the gym. It's inseparable from time and space. So, but I guess my religious upbringing didn't come with that particular brand of self-consciousness about my body. And, And so, yeah, just that just like it popped up in my mind when I was walking here today to have this conversation with you to ask
that's fascinating.
How yeah. I could have, how, if I could have said something that would be more supportive.
I mean, it's
there,
very funny.
But also, but yeah, but. But
what you said, I mean, is like
right.
That very,
well,
very, very
no
quick.
One else laughed.
Yeah, no, right.
I would have. I would have laughed.
I am. Yeah, I'm laughing now. But
yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. I don't think realistically you could have done anything else. And I'm curious how she'll reflect on this later. I don't even think I've shared this with Jeremiah because this is like such a benign anecdote. But I remember the first time, because I love to exercise, I remember the first time I went to the gym and I didn't wear a tank top. And I think it might have been like some sort of heated class. And I just had this thought of, why the fuck am I wearing this extra t-shirt? Like, I don't need this t-shirt. I'm taking it off. And it was such an empowering moment. And I don't wear t-shirts to the gym. I haven't worn t-shirts to the gym in years, but that moment was a powerful moment. Mm. And strangely, although not strangely, I talk with my individual clients about clothes quite a bit because one of the healing parts of recovering from adverse religious experiences for many people, men and women, especially women, is like learning how to dress again and right. learning how mm-hmm. to dress without the restrictions of purity culture. And that might mean showing more skin, but it also might mean the type of jewelry that they wear or right. their haircut or the lipstick they may or may not want. And it's actually a really fun part of therapy to talk to clients about, what do you want to wear? What do you want to look like? Mm-hmm. And no, you don't need to wear the fucking t-shirt if you don't want to wear the fucking t-shirt.
Well, it's like, and sometimes you don't even realize that you're wearing an extra layer of clothing until you're so fucking uncomfortable yeah. that you're like, if only yeah. I could be more comfortable yeah. right now. And then it's like, oh yeah, I can take this off.
Yeah. So something I'm just curious about, like when it comes to couples who are devout in their religion. I'm making an assumption here, but like the shame that comes with religion, I'm guessing affects different people in different ways, some more than others. And so when you have two people that come from the same religion, perhaps you have one that feels shame greater than the other, or one that subscribes to a particular belief, whereas the other one maybe doesn't really, but you know, whether they say that or not. And so, but of course, like when it comes to, let's say, their relationship in the bedroom or their relationship, you know, when it comes to intimacy, maybe that's where it sort of arises. And you have one person whose beliefs kind of clash up against somebody else's when they're in a relationship. They're both in the same religion. They both, you know, neither of them are one foot out the door. Like they're in it fully, but their beliefs or their feelings around shame don't really connect. What does that look like? And what are some things that whether it's through your practice or that you've, you know, examples that you've heard of, but like, what, you know, how do people approach that? How do people handle that?
I can think about this from my own experience, getting married very, very young within a religious context. I was a client in sex therapy before I became a sex therapist. My ex-husband and I went to therapy, and during our first session with, God bless, Nancy McGrath of Boston, she asked about communities and family of origin. And I said, well, I grew up in this fringy, strange kind of community, and it was religious, but I just really don't think it impacted my sexuality all that much. And Nancy was such an amazing sex therapist and couples therapist because she was able to brilliantly pace the work that that we needed to do. With couples of different sex or gender, a couple observations. One, I think that men who grow up in purity culture, anecdotally, I think that they start to reckon with the intensity of the impact when they are partnered with women who grow up in purity culture spaces. I think if they engage the sexual relationship and the relationship well, they learn what they might not have understood or learned in other contexts, which is not a criticism, but mm-hmm. that tends to be something that really forces men to confront the sexism and misogyny within Christian spaces.
Right.
And right. we talk quite a bit about the negative impact of purity culture on women, and that's deserved. That being said, the double bind that men find themselves in is that on one hand, they learn that they are like sexual monsters with uncontrollable sexual urges. That's actually language that I learned growing up, that men have uncontrollable sexual urges, which is why I, as an 8-year-old, can't wear spaghetti straps. Yeah. And they learn that that is how God made them, that God made them to be sexually dominant and sexually aggressive. And they also learn that that's the thing that they have to fight more than anything else. So they're stuck in this double bind of God made me to be very sexual, but I've got to fight these sinful urges. And then right. they're partnered with a woman who's had crushing, crushing, devastating pressure from prepubescent times. And then you're reckoning with that in the same relationship. And that's some heavy shit.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. I mean, the amount of turmoil that could bring up within a relationship is hard to fucking comprehend, you know? Like,
yeah.
I can only imagine. But what about the not the inverse of that, but you know, say one side of the couple is that man who grew up with those beliefs or those thoughts, and like those are ingrained, but then finds himself in a relationship with someone who identifies as Christian, but also someone who's like, you know, I'm a fucking woman, and I have needs, and I have a sexuality, and you know, I don't subscribe to that shit. But I, you know, I have a belief in God, and I have these things. So it's like, you know, what kinds of issues can arise there? And is that, you know, I feel like I'm asking for examples of like these hypothetical people that are just in my mind that I'm just like fucking write, like I'm writing a script for characters or some shit. But I'm just curious about like this thing is so layered, and there's so many different mm-hmm. variables, and right. there's so many different ways that this can arise, because there's so much to unpack. And I guess I'm just kind of like, oh fuck, what happens? What happens when you've got a woman who's sexually liberated and comfortable and free, but also is like, you know, devout to God. And you've got a man who just has a bunch of shit that he has not unpacked, and it's fucking with his head.
One of the hard things about sex therapy in working with religious folks is that the feedback, Julia, that you and I give around sexuality, which is, as I said earlier, about as much openness as we can, giving people as many options as they can. And also, Jeremy, much like you were saying about like scripting, like that's what Julia and I do in couples and sex therapy as well, is we talk as specifically as we can about like what are ideal experiences that you want to have, sexually or otherwise. And one of the hard things that comes up for folks in religious spaces, both for men and women, is that folks haven't been given permission to either think about what they want or to talk about what they want.
Yeah.
And to talk about what they want specifically in relational spaces. If they have been given permission to talk about what they want, this happens more with men than with women. It comes out in this really kind of unilateral, kind of controlling kind of way. And that can create some hard dynamics. But one of the things that we are really aware of is that when we're talking with folks about sexuality, when we're asking folks to, and when we're using anatomically correct terminology, penis, vulva, vagina, talking about the distinction between vulva and vagina, when we're talking about different types of sexuality, which can and doesn't have to include intercourse, and even that idea can be mm-hmm. mind-blowing to mm-hmm. A lot of folks. What we often see is that these questions also begin to kind of chip away at a person's understanding of religion and practice and commitment to religion,
specifically like evangelical, Mormon, and Pentecostal religions.
That's right. Those are the three religious groups that we study. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so one of the things that we try to be careful with, and I'm glad that you used the word pace earlier, Julia, when you were talking about this. This is slow work.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt.
This is really, really intentional work. It involves a lot of checking in. Hey, how are you doing? Mm-hmm. Kind of receiving this. What was it like for me to ask you that question? What was it like for me to use the word penis rather than dick? You know, what was it like for us to talk this explicitly about what you might want and to kind of hypothetically stage it in the way that we're doing it? Mm. So it can be really, really challenging work. And I think that another big challenge is for couples who are going through this. You think, well, you know, I just want to like work with someone who's a couples therapist who does couples therapy. Like a lot of couples therapists may not understand the importance to go extra, extra slow.
Sure.
In these types of spaces. So for couples who are listening to this show, who might fall into this category, I highly encourage you to ask a couples therapist that you might interview, what's your experience with religion and working with people who are, who have religious practices and are potentially considering how that might look in their lives.
Does, especially speaking from like the sort of evangelical types of Christianity, does the religion itself often become a barrier to access when looking to seek like relationship therapy or couples therapy?
Yeah.
Especially in Boston and in certain pockets of the US. Now, as we were mentioning earlier, anyone in the US and in other parts of the world as well who received abstinence-only education or other kinds of messaging, nobody really escapes some of those religious messagings in the US. That being said, I've had many clients say, oh, thank God you understand what my background is like, because if I start talking to you about like being afraid of the rapture and that impacting anxiety and then that impacts my sexuality, like, thank goodness you know.
Yeah.
So it can be a barrier. And within the sexual health community, there is a fairly like anti-religious bias. And what I tell clients like right away at the onset is, hey, I have an expertise in folks who have survived adverse religious experiences. Also, I have no stake in your religious identification. So wherever you fall on that spectrum throughout our work, if you decide in therapy that like, fuck it, I have to leave my community, I have to leave my marriage, I have to do whatever, I'm like, that's fine. But you might say, no, it's really important for me to keep not just spirituality, but religion. It's really important for me to keep Christianity. Great. We'll work with that too. And those are just two options of many. So I think it's important to share with folks, I understand this, and I'm not going to have a bias or a stake in wherever you land. Like, my only interest is that you flourish as a human being, as a sexual person, to whatever extent you want that to look like, and that you've got flourishing relationships.
The other thing that I would add, Jeremy, to your question is recognizing that, first of all, there's a multi-billion-dollar Christian publishing industry that writes a lot of information about relationships, about self-help, even books that you wouldn't even think are Christian publishing. Two examples are Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, fits within that realm, and also The Five Love Languages. These are books. Many of these books are not written by relationship experts. They're written by clergy. One of the unique things about working with me and Julia is like we have a combined 30 years between the two of us of studying the science of relationships. And that, you know, the things that relational health, the relationship science says about what successful relationships are often quite different from what you read in Christian self-help books that are written from the perspective of the performance of gender, the performance of Well, if men take leadership roles, women should be submissive. Here's men how you do this. Here's women how you do this. Mm-hmm. And then here's how you kind of work within that framework. So another barrier is a lot of the content that's being written in the name of relational health is actually not being written by people who've studied this.
Yeah, that's true.
Interesting.
The other thing that I'll add to that is sometimes people feel embarrassed. So let's say a person grew up in a fundamentalist or high control religious group, they leave it. They might be really embarrassed that they have limited sexual experiences. Sure. They might be embarrassed that anxiety is really high. I had friends who have shared this publicly, so I can repeat it. They got married very, very young. They were very much struggling with sexuality on their honeymoon because it was completely off limits prior to that. And they were Googling floor play because they got confused with foreplay and floor play. And they had such little resources that they were like, this isn't working. Let's Google floor play because we hear that's important for sex. And like, they laugh about this now. Like, it is actually hilarious, but it was so devastating to them at the time. And for good reasons, particularly in the States, like evangelical Christianity has been so harmful that people are really like, they don't want to admit for good reasons, like, oh my gosh, I grew up in this cultish community. I don't know really basic information. Like, is my therapist going to judge me? Right. Is my therapist going to judge me because I was a part of an institution that's been harmful? Is my therapist going to judge me because I'm just like too afraid to even name some of these things?
Mm. Or will they put me on the defensive about like that? Right. Right. Like, not even just judge me, but like, do I have to show up and like protect this part of me?
Right.
Yeah, I just Googled floor play and
I was wondering if you were doing
it would
that.
It would be pretty confusing to pull up floor play, which is a Canadian sock store. Canadian sock store since 2013.
You know what they say about our socks.
Yeah. Right. Floor play socks has socks for every occasion.
Including sex. Yes.
That's right.
Yes. Business socks.
All kinds of sex too. Swinging sex.
They knew what they
were
doing.
Kinky sex.
Just as long as you're wearing four play socks, you're good to go.
That's it. Yeah.
Don't you dare take those socks off.
Have you worked, because you've been talking about counseling couples and people who have religious backgrounds, but what about people who are still like active, let's say in the Mormon church, like, or in a situation where a partnership is ending because one person is committed to that community and another one is leaving?
Like how both of us got divorced, how that happened in our lives.
That is a very, that is a very lived experience. So
yeah.
I can answer that from the perspective of the couples therapy that I wish that I had received. Were I to have gone through that process with my ex, because my ex and I ended up separating about 5 months after I got fired from the church that I had worked at. She had worked there as well. And there was a ton of avoidance that followed. That's actually one of the big relationship dynamics that we see is not just the lack of vocabulary, the lack of vernacular, but the active resistance to entering into these types of conversations, and not just kind of sheltering those parts in kind of this tentative kind of way, but actively like resisting against moving into those spaces. That actually unfortunately happened in my relationship. I had mentioned 3 or 4 times wanting to move into couples therapy, connected with the more that I kind of studied sexuality, sex therapy, connected with religion, connected with sexuality, and those requests were rebuffed, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So I wish that, you know, had we had the capacity to do that, to move into couples therapy, I wish that we had the opportunity to talk together about some of the harm that happens. I think my ex had a ton of shame, a ton of resistance, unwillingness to talk about that, and a desire to protect her family, to protect maybe the religious institutions that were important to her. Like I get it. I think that one of the things that's really, really important in those spaces is the practice of empathy. The practice of kind of a mutual understanding, and really, really unpacking just the depth of, you know, the shit that both partners are going through.
Yeah. And I had great couples therapy, with my ex-husband. So what I will also tell clients is, similarly to religion, I have no stake in where clients end relationally. Sometimes in therapy, you decide to end the relationship, which is what happened with my ex-husband and I. And although I wish I could go back and do some parts of our goodbye differently, we actually had some really beautiful experiences in saying goodbye to each other. So it is not a failing for a relationship to decide to end for any number of reasons. And again, my bias or my stake, my claim is that people flourish. And sadly, when I got divorced, I received massive public shame from my community. And it's sad that they cared more about my allegiance to a religious group versus like my well-being as a human being. So sometimes people decide to stay together and they do really, really hard work in navigating the impact of religious harm, and they can move into really thriving, flourishing spaces. And sometimes people make the choice to end the relationship.
Yeah, I mean, is it, I can imagine that it's much more common if a relationship gets to a point where one person within the relationship has a falling out with the belief and the religion, and the other one does not. I can imagine that more often than not, that's going to be such a big enough issue that it is detrimental to the relationship in the end. But is it, are there examples, or have you heard of examples where that's happened and they've come out on the other side of that still with a strong, loving relationship and stayed together?
Yeah, one of the things that has to happen is for a lot of couples, so I'm thinking about my ex and I, religion was very much an organizing principle. Like, it was a thing that brought the relationship together. We both met through worship ministry. Right. We did worship ministry together. Like, that was a key part of our relationship. And when I got fired from the church, that was removed from our relationship. And we couldn't figure out another way to develop something some things to hold us together, to connect the relationship around. We've done some interviews with folks. I'm thinking about an interview that we did on our podcast a bit back, where couples are figuring out how to discover new experiences. It could be travel, for instance. Oftentimes it's a connection around the kids, which can have its own kind of complications, with the relationship. But that's a really, really key factor for success for couples navigating the deconstruction experience together, is finding new, things, new topics, new issues, new events, new interests to center the relationship around.
You have to build a new foundation.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's so fascinating.
It is all of it. Like, it's just, it is so fascinating. I love talking about this stuff. And you know, I know that I'm not alone in feeling that fascination and interest in this topic, which, you just mentioned it. You guys have a podcast. How can people find you guys? How can people find the work that you do? How can they find the podcast?
Yeah, so the podcast Sex Evangelicals is on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. We release new episodes every week. And we also have a Substack called Relationship 101. We write and release new articles. This is the research on relationships, on communication, We tried to connect it into our specific research interests on working with evangelical couples and couples where one or both people are leaving evangelical Mormon or Pentecostal spaces. You can sign up for that online. We'd also love donations, of course, so we can continue to write and research and do this work that's really meaningful for us. Anything else that you want to plug? Oh, we're on Instagram and Threads at Sex Evangelicals.
Guys, this has been such a delightful conversation. Thank you so much for being so open to speaking about your own personal experiences, but also just giving us such a deep dive into your work. Again, super fascinating. And this has just been a really, really lovely conversation. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for hosting us.
Thanks for your questions.
What a wonderful way to end a Friday.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then going to the gym.
Yeah. Where God will not be working out today.
That's right.
Yes.
As we all know. That's
or maybe. I don't. What do I know?
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. There we have it, folks. Hope you enjoyed that conversation that we just had. And thanks for listening to the podcast. If you want to support the podcast further, you can do that by leaving a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, or you can simply rate the podcast on the Spotify mobile app. And if you want to support the podcast even further than that, which you can.
Wow.
You can
go
to
so kind and thoughtful and
so
generous.
Thoughtful, so generous. Go to patreon.com/turnmeon. To become a patron and help us keep this podcast afloat.
Well, if you want to reach out to us, turnmeonpodcast@gmail.com is always open for all of your messages. That's the best way to get in touch. If you have a question for us, if you'd like to be a guest on the show, if you have a recommendation for a guest on the show, or if you just want to send us a little love note, email, money transfer, all of that.
Sex toy.
You know, our email inbox is open to you.
That is it for this week. Until next week.
Why don't you go touch yourself?